Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
We are here with our guest, Lauren Spivak. Say hi, Lauren.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi.
I never know I was supposed to say hi at that point.
I was directing you with my eyes.
We're not like other shows.
No. Other shows, they try to be all professional and, you know.
Yeah, that's boring.
It's stupid. We're all about the... We're kind of like NASCAR, you know? You always sit in turn four because that's where all the wrecks are. Just makes it more fun.
Well, it's just the place that I wanted to be.
Exactly. So. Lauren is the free market warrior. He was born and raised in Massachusetts, spent most of his adult life in New York City, neither of which we will hold against you. Before becoming active in politics, he worked for several nonprofits as a management consultant for both profit and nonprofit companies. He founded Free Market Warrior in 2009 in an effort to make a positive difference in American politics and economics. And although we're not going to discuss them in depth today, he has three terrific books that are loads of fun. Very educational, but loads of fun. The New Democrat, which is a parody on The Cat in the Hat. Oh, wait.
And a parody of the Obama years.
Yes, the Obama years and Salon.com. We can't forget the review. The most twisted piece of conservative propaganda print out there.
I love that.
A badge of honor.
Gotta like that.
Lest you think I don't get good reviews.
Yeah, just in case. You know, it's always good when your enemies are after you. And then The Gorax, which was a kind of, it's not really a spoof exactly, but it was a parody on The Lorax, and it's all about the...
It's an anti-environmentalist parody. It's about, it has Al Gore as The Lorax, and it's about how the environmentalists are destroying our country.
Exactly. And they are. And continue, so the book will be popular forever. Third book, The Wizard of Iz, is a parody of the Democrats. And for those of you that are still irritated with Hillary, as we all should be forever, she is actually the witch. And the illustrations on all of these are incredible and amazing.
When did that book come out, Lauren?
The Wizard of Iz?
Yes.
The first edition of The Wizard of Iz came out... Was it last year? What is this? This way, it came out in late 2015.
Okay.
This is already updated. It's the second edition, and it gets into a lot of things. You never mentioned the cowardly rhino.
No, the cowardly rhino was terrific, and he's John
Boehner. The cowardly lion has been replaced by the cowardly rhino, who suspects the Democrats are up to no good, but he's scared to do anything about it. He's looking for the courage to do something useful when he gets to Washington.
And Clinton is the wizard.
Bill Clinton is the wizard
who runs around in his boxer shorts the whole time,
and is all full of baloney. I think the cowardly rhino of all three books, I think my single best character is the cowardly rhino's. You know, in my judgment, I just think he just came out perfectly.
Yeah, he did.
If you look, he has the exact right thing to say in every single scene that just works perfectly, I think.
And he's just like the Cowardly Lion, for those of you who like the original scene.
And where can you pick those books up?
Well, the website is Dr. Truth Books, which is drtruthbooks, all one word, .com. And they make awesome gifts for, you know, conservative people if you happen to know any.
They do. And you might even slip them to your other family members that maybe are on the fence.
Yeah. Or you want them to, like, stop talking to you for a while.
Exactly. They could be a breakup gift.
That's right.
Yeah. They are a terrific read, though. They're very entertaining.
All right. So we're giving the book short shrift because we only have Lauren for an hour, and we wanted to talk about democracy. The hated democracy. So
yeah, the good and the bad.
Yeah. But you had said that whenever you tell people that you dislike democracy, they get all mad.
Well, yeah, there's an idea that if you don't like democracy, then you must like dictatorship. Because the way, you know, we've discussed previously, you know, the failures of the educational system, and the failures of the educational system, you know, is such that people think that there's two options. You either want democracy or you want Hitler.
Or you want something bad.
Yeah, those are your two choices. And that really is not true at all. Democracy is a system in which the majority tells the minority what to do. And I have a great deal of trouble with that. I don't think that that majorities understand what they ought to do themselves very well, let alone what other people should do.
You could also call that mob rule.
Well, it is. I mean, I was trying to think of what the difference was between a democracy and a mob rule. And the only difference I can tell is if you're part of the mob, if the mob is your has on your side, then that's democracy. And if the mob's on the other side, it's mob rule. But it's very you know questionable, and we tend to assume, you know, if you wanted to think of everything that I do and every talk I've given to everybody everywhere, which is a whole lot of talks, what I always try to do is go to the underlying assumption that's wrong somewhere at the base. I try not to prune the branches. I try to go right down to the roots and figure out what the root issue here, and the assumption that democracy is just inherently good and right, and that, you know, 51% of the people, you know, just have the God-given right to tell the other 49% what to do, is highly questionable. And I'm not interested in a dictatorship either. A dictatorship is, you know, one person, you know, telling everybody else what to do, and I don't want that either. There is a very good alternative to democracy that's right at our fingertips, and it's called capitalism. And people say to me, well, that's an economic system, and democracy is a political system, so you're comparing apples and oranges. And I disagree. It is not apples and oranges, because in both cases, you know, the issue is, in any society anywhere, whatever your system of government is, the issue in any society is, what are we going to do with the stuff that we have? You know, we've got resources, we've got people, we've got buildings and factories and natural resources, we've got a bunch of things. What are we going to do with them? And the dictatorship answer is the dictator decides what everything is good, what's going to be going to be done with everything. The democracy is that the 51% tell the 49% what to do with their stuff. And the capitalist model is that everyone decides for their own resources. And, you know, so my money that I've earned and my property that I own, I get to decide, and you get to decide for yours. And the only kind, and the interaction, and interactions happen all the time, and they're great, are voluntary interactions. If there's some business deal where it makes you happy and it makes me happy and we're both benefiting, then that's great. But neither of us ought to have the power to use government to force things down other people's throats. And it has several advantages. First of all, on the smaller scale, individual people are far more likely to understand all the ins and outs of their resources and able to make wiser decisions about the land they own, the money they have, etc., than somebody, you know, than a bunch of congressmen in Washington deciding how to appropriately utilize my land, you know, on the other side of the country. You know, how do they possibly know that?
Sure.
They make some general rule for everybody. I am and you too. I don't mean myself personally. I mean everybody is a much better custodian of their own property and their own money than anybody else is. You know, who spends other people's money as wisely as they spend their own money? You know, that's where we go. When I was in business, I remember I used to, you know, I would sign off on things we had to pay, and, you know, there would be a bill from the, you know, the phone company for, you know, $17,000. And I like, all right, there we go. I signed it. Next bill. And, you know, if it's my bill at my house and it's, you know, and it's 50 cents too high.
We're turning some lights off.
I'm going through the roof. I'm like calling them up and screaming at them because they got it off by 50 cents. Everybody treats their own money much more intelligently than they treat other people's money. It's just natural. And so because finally what it leads to is you've got an incentive.
Sure.
If I treat my property well and I use it wisely and I maintain it, and then that's good for me in the long run. When somebody else is doing this, particularly people I've never met from thousands of miles away who know nothing about what's going on here and frankly don't really care about the specific issues in my life and my family and my property and my kids. I'll throw my kids in there too, because I think I should decide how my kids get educated, not the state, not democracy. So, it's a highly flawed system because of that. And I'll tell you, I know you like to link books on your website. I will suggest one, if I may, which is called Democracy, The God That Failed, by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And it's a fascinating book, which, you know, gets into some details about, you know, what I believe also, that democracy does not work very well. And he makes some fascinating points, one of which is he suggests that in some ways monarchy works better than democracy. And his logic is like this, that the monarch owns the country. I mean, that's what the feudalistic model of monarchy is. If you're the king of England in 1400, you own England. It is your personal property. And everyone kind of works for you. And then when you die, you pass it on to your kid. And he becomes the new king of England. And the reason this may work better is that because of this, you have every incentive to keep the country as strong and prosperous as possible. Not only during your life, because you want a happy, prosperous kingdom, because that puts you higher up, but also you want to pass it on to your kids.
Sure.
The same reason I would take care of my house that I'm planning to pass on to my kids. I care about my kids. I want them to have a nice house.
Have a nice house.
So, in democracy, what happens? Well, one party gets elected and they come into power. And do they have an incentive to preserve things for the long run? No. They have an incentive to loot everything they can in the short run because they know they're not going to be there forever. They know that they're going to boot it out of office sooner or later, and they spend all the government money they possibly can on all their friends and get whatever they get to that's in their interest, that's not in the long term interest of the country. And then you would say, well, the other party has an incentive to call everyone's attention to this and say, look what they're doing.
But they don't, because they're making plans of their own.
But they don't. That's right, because they know that they're going to be in there next. It's going to be their turn to loot. And the last thing they want to do is you know, call attention to the looting.
Cool. Funny how that works.
Yep.
All right, we're going to chat more about this in a couple of minutes. We'll have a little capitalistic celebration right now for 2 minutes.
Okay.
We forgot to do celebration of capitalism. We just had Lauren on the show. So please check the website, and you can catch up with all his other ideas, because we've had some great times with him. The site is wethepeopleradio.us. So we should be talking about Illinois freedom. Those guys are in deep trouble.
There's a failure of democracy right there, by the way. You know, that people can vote to spend more and more money, and they don't really want to vote to get to tax themselves, you know, as much as they want to spend the money.
Right.
And so you have an inevitable kind of, you know, descent into debt.
Sure. And, well, they vote all these high pensions and...
Sure.
I mean, we're seeing that here in our local area.
And who could be against that?
Right. Give everybody more.
And the governor has every incentive to give, you know, whatever the unions want, because they're a huge political force. The union, yep. If the governor gives the union what it wants, then the union will get all their people voting for the governor.
Well, and I guess in Illinois, the governor is actually... has been advocating all these cuts.
This current governor, yes.
What's happening right now. I guess he's been advocating. I haven't been following their politics that much, but I was listening to a thing
this morning.
But
we're living in the wake of a bunch of other governors.
Correct.
Most of whom, if I understand correctly, are still living in state-owned housing. The former governors of Illinois.
Pretty good gig if you can get it, huh?
They're in prison.
The
prisons of Illinois filled with former governors.
Nice.
So they go from one government house.
Okay, that's not a good gig.
That's not a good gig.
To another government house.
Well, they apparently the speaker of the legislature there in Illinois, it's like the longest serving speaker, I don't know, in history or something like that. So that guy's just like, yep, nope, we're not gonna cut anything. So that's real nice. Yep, we're going broke. Well, we don't care. Hit the gas! I don't see it. Well, you were talking about the monarchy, so go back on the monarchy there.
Well, it's the idea that we assume that a show of hands, you know, is the best way to determine smart policy, and it's really not, because people can individually. Usually, I'm not saying, first of all, humans are never perfect. Let's be clear here. We all human beings will screw up from time to time. That's just absolutely inevitable. But so the issue is not perfection, which is, by the way, a huge argument we have with the socialists, because the socialists think that once the right guy gets in there,
perfection
will have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never going to arrive, because human beings are never perfect. And what socialists always do is they point to some imperfection in capitalism. They say, well, yeah, sure, people are 2,000 times richer than they were 200 years ago, but that guy is poorer than his neighbor, so therefore the whole capitalist system has to go out the window, and we have to put Bernie Sanders in charge of everybody's life because that guy, you know, doesn't make enough money. And so that's a game that they play. But we make decisions way better on the individual level than we do on the collective level, largely because of two things. One is our ability to comprehend. You know, our brain is not designed to understand 350 million people and all their needs and wants and jobs and activities and dreams for the future. It's impossible. And so you know, even if you're trying to get everybody what they want, okay, you don't know what everybody wants, and neither do I, and neither does anybody else who thinks themselves fit to run the society. But what we do know is our own life, what we want and what our dreams and our plans are, what we'd like to do with our property. And it works so much better when you decentralize that, which is what capitalism is. It's a decentralized system. And then what's next? Well, the next question people ask me is, well, are we going to have any laws at all? And this is very important. I think we ought to have laws, but we don't need new laws. And that's a huge difference. There are some basic things that need to be against the law, and they were all against the law hundreds of years ago. Murder needs to be against the law. Stealing stuff and assaulting people needs to be against the law. These are very clear-cut. It's also worth noting that they are non-controversial. In fact, one of my pet proposals to improve our current system, you know, incrementally, is I think that Congress should not pass any laws at all without a two-thirds majority. It shouldn't just be for overriding vetoes. I think if you can't get two-thirds in both chambers, you don't make the law at all. And I do that in the state legislature level, too. And if we did that, what would happen? Well, we'd still have laws against murder and robbery, because they'd get nine, you know, who? Do you know one single congressman who would not vote to make murder and robbery illegal? Okay, you'd have no problem with that at all. But you wouldn't get things like Obamacare, which are trying to micromanage everybody's life in the whole country. And why will that not happen? Because we shouldn't do that. We should leave people alone to make their own decisions. So requiring a supermajority for anything would actually greatly slow down the legislation process, which is good. It's what our founding fathers wanted, was slower legislation. But also, it will allow the obvious things to go that we really need, that have always been there, to go through. Hayek says something fascinating. Friedrich Hayek is another person I quote a lot. He says that legislatures don't make laws at all. He says that's not what law is. His is a misnomer. He says that's really just legislation. He said what comes out of legislatures is legislation. Laws are something that are built in to the nature of being human, Hayek says. And he says, we don't make laws, we discover them. In other words, the process of human history is a process of discovering what laws a society needs to have. Because the society that stumbles across a wise and prudent and limited set of laws that is enough to make peace at home but not stifle creativity, right? That's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
That society will grow and prosper and thrive. And societies that either don't have the appropriate laws because they let people go around killing each other, or they have way too many laws, laws and are oppressive and stifle creativity, those societies are going to die, and the superior societies are going to live. Sorry to offend your politically correct listeners, but the better societies will survive and thrive and pass these ideas along, and societies that aren't so well organized will fall by the wayside. So there is a process of discovery. You know, the whole concept of how we handle, and I'm a huge admirer of it, by the way, the whole way we handle criminal justice, you know, that you're entitled to a lawyer, that you're entitled to a trial by jury, that you have, you're entitled to question witnesses against you. You know, this is really good stuff, and it's a very, very good, in fact, I would say brilliant, concept we have to get as, you know, because human beings are never going to know for sure. You know, we can't read somebody's mind and know whether he's innocent or guilty. We can't, you know, we don't have a crystal ball to look into. But it's a very good, excellent system for figuring out who's guilty and who's innocent and applying the punishments appropriately. Well, that system, nobody just snapped their fingers and put that into effect. That system was the process of literally thousands of years of societal evolution, going back to the earliest Norman kings in England. It was what's his name? Henry II was the first, you know, a person who really developed the concept of jury trial in Britain, and it evolved in Britain and evolved in the United States. You know, fairly, you know there have been fairly recent details, you know, that have been added onto it. Some of which, you know, look pretty good. Some of which are more questionable. But it's a long term process, and that works not because we elected the best legislators, but because you know we've hearkened to this tradition that's been brought down to us. So we need laws, but we stop having new laws. I think one of the worst mistakes that our founding fathers made is the institution of the sitting legislature. I think that we ought to stick with a certain set of laws, and there are rarely needs to change them. And the only time you need to change them that I can see is when you have technological changes. So, for example, you know, it used to be to sign a contract, you needed pen and paper.
Right.
And in the modern world, people sign contracts all the time by clicking a mouse on their computer. Okay, laws did have to change to make that a legitimate contract.
Same too with privacy.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it was physical privacy before, going into your house.
Sure.
And now it's a telephone that you carry around that has data and documents on it.
And all my friends and all my communications.
Yeah, unfortunately, what we see a lot of, though, is the government passing laws that allow the government to control our ability to manage our own property.
Well, the government ends up, you know, pursuing its own interests,
right.
which is where we're kind of swinging into the next chapter here of what's wrong with democracy, is that when we were we had a simple concept of government, that the government is in charge, you know, that murder is against the law and robbery is against the law, and the job of the government is to catch the bad guys who break those fundamental laws and put them on trial and lock them up or whatever if necessary, and to defend the country against foreign invasion.
Right.
When that was the job of government, it was pretty straightforward.
Pretty simple.
It was simple, and all when the legislators voted to make murder illegal, they knew exactly what they were doing. It could not be clearer what they were voting for, and virtually all of the citizens, even I suspect most murderers, if you went to prison and interviewed the murderers, I suspect most murderers would agree that murder does need to be against the law. They may have wished they got away with their particular murder, but I think
agreed with the exception.
That's right. I don't think very many of them would say no murder should be legal. I really don't, because virtually everybody can agree with that. So when it was simple like that, democracy worked fairly well, okay? I'm no longer talking about what Hoppe says, I'm talking about what I'm saying. But then when we loaded it up with all the stuff where the government's deciding our health care and the government's deciding what we can do with our land and what we do with our house and our car and how my car has to be built and what its gas mileage has to be.
Bathroom bill.
And who gets to go use what bathroom. I mean, just when every single nook and cranny of everybody's life is going through government, and this is, we're now now on to what stuff Hayek says. But what Friedrich Hayek, the famous Austrian economist, says is that democracy falls apart in this because the legislators themselves cannot possibly understand this. The law against murder fit on one page. The law for Obamacare was 2,000 pages long. How many congressmen who voted for that had read those 2,000 pages?
Well, see, the thing is,
the answer is none of them.
But a lot of them did read it, even though they voted against it. They may have read it. The problem is, the law isn't the regulation. Yeah, so what's actually going to affect you is not technically the law. It's how it gets rolled out.
Because the law passes this law on to unelected bodies.
There
correct. Who figure out how to apply it. So you take a 2,000-page law and then put thousands of pages of regulation on top of that. So you're...
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's an exponential growth.
And another good example, by the way, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau law, which was passed.
Oh, hold that thought. Let's come back on that one.
That one's an utter disaster. And basically what the law does is put this guy in charge of this consumer who can't be removed for 10 years, no matter what, unless he does a crime. The only way to possibly remove him is to be impeached by Congress. And the law doesn't say these are the regulations. The law possibly says he's empowered to make whatever regulations he sees fit
to keep everyone safe.
That's where we fall apart. Let's hold that thought.
Okay, hold that thought.
We'll take a break.
Right back.
Want to talk about that because the bureaucracy is
and that's all that's up for debate right now. The Consumer Financial Protection
Act. And it should be
exactly. We'll be right back. Our guest is Lawrence Bevack. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That'd be the goal. Okay, back to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You were asking us where they got all their money.
Oh, I'm going to tell you where they get all their money, and it's amazing. They're not on budget. They do not have a budget that comes from the Congress like the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to appropriate all the money that's spent by the government.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they're not in Congress's budget at all, not in the least. Do you know where they get their money from? They get their money from the Federal Reserve. Do you know what that means? That means it gets printed just for them. The Federal Reserve doesn't have any of its own money. It just prints money.
Sure.
And so the freshly printed money pays for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which means that there is no congressional oversight over this at all. They have spent billions of dollars, this bureau, on themselves. And it was a congressman a couple months back who questioned the head of the bureau because he had spent $300 million renovating a building which cost $100 million.
Wow.
And you know what he said to the congressman?
Oh, God.
He said, are you ready what he said to the congressman?
Yeah,
he said, why do you care? That's not your money. We just see it gets printed for us by the Federal Reserve, okay? So we've got an agency here.
And when did these guys come in? This has been two years?
This was one of the first things that Obama... No, it's longer than that. This was one of the first things Obama did. This was back in those first 2 years of Obama when the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress before the Tea Party Revolution. This all happened in 2009 when Obama came in and like, well, we can't let these nasty capitalists, do all these crazy bad things to our economy anymore, so we need this new protection bureau. So what we've got here is an agency that spends billions of dollars completely off budget, and no one has any control over this at all because they basically literally have a license to print money. I mean, that's, when I was a kid, that was a joke. You know,
what
do you have a license to print money? Well,
right.
their answer is yes, we do.
They didn't even plant the tree to get it off.
we just print our own, whatever we need. And then you've got a guy in charge of it who has been empowered by the law basically to make up his own policy. The law doesn't say this is the policy that you're to enforce. See, the normal way it's supposed to work is that Congress makes a law and the enforcement agency enforces the law. But their law just says he decides. So
go keep consumers safe.
Yeah. So he just goes into whatever businesses and investors and stockbrokers are doing and decides what he likes and what he doesn't like and says, oh, I've decided that. And then finally, you can't get rid of him for 10 years because he can't be fired by anybody. And the only way to get rid of him is by impeachment, which means you have to impeach him in the House and have a trial in the Senate. And that's only for malfeasance. That's not for having really bad policies, okay? You have to, he has to commit a crime to be removed. If he just has the worst policies ever, you're stuck with him for 10 years. And I want you to understand, this is all a product of democracy. And this is exactly what Hayek predicts in The Road to Serfdom, that when government is not just catching murderers and protecting from foreign invasion, okay, when government's running everybody, the financial markets and the healthcare market, and it's in every corner of everybody's life and the environment and jobs and employment, everything else, that what happens is that congressmen cannot possibly understand all of these things and handle every circumstance, because as I already explained, it's too complicated. So what they tend to do, and it's a very bad tendency, but they do tend to do it, is to simply vote these powers onto unelected boards. So when we complain about, things like death panels and Obamacare, what people like Bernie Sanders would say is, but we're still a democracy. We're not like Venezuela or North Korea. We're a democracy, and if you're unhappy, you can voice it in the next election. But you can't, because the guy at the medical panel who is deciding whether you deserve that operation you need, but you know what? You look kind of old to me.
You've outlived your usefulness.
Yeah, that's right. I think you need to go home and die, right? and stop clogging up our medical system. The guy who says that to you, you can't vote for him. How are you supposed to, what are you supposed to do in the next election? And the answer is you can do nothing. To this bureaucrat, you are just a vassal. You are a peasant kneeling before the Duke and hoping for his favor, that he'll do what you want, and he has all the power. So what we're seeing here is that when you try to have a democracy, but you, at the same time, you're trying to have this whole socialist structure where they're running every detail of the country, it falls apart. And that's the first way that it falls apart. There's a second way that it falls apart also, which Hayek talks about, and that is that if you try, because the ultimate point here is you're making a plan for the entire country. You're deciding who gets what health care, who gets what job, who gets what money. Again, Sanders is very clear about this. He wants to, decide who, make sure you get a living wage, but you're not making too much. Okay, so if you have an economic plan that determines what everybody's doing, what everyone's going to get paid, how everyone's going to live their life, and how everything in the entire economy is going to function, what are the chances of getting an actual majority of the population to approve that plan? And the answer is zero, because the plan determines everybody's income and everybody's future. And everybody thinks that they should get paid more and that other people should get paid less. Okay?
Right.
Now, if all government's doing is making murder and robbery against the law, that's fine. Everyone agrees on that. But when the economic plan says this is how much money you're going to earn, and this is how much money that I'm going to earn, this is how much money he's going to earn, what is the chance of actually getting 51% of the voters to agree on something here? And the answer is zero. You can't possibly make everybody happy like that. If the government stays out of it and lets the free market decide what people get paid, people can actually live with that. I mean, they may not be thrilled, but if I go around looking, if I want to make $100,000 a year and I go looking around and nobody was willing to pay me $100,000 a year, at some point I'm going to conclude I'm really just not worth $100,000 a year, and I'm going to have to live with what the best offer I can get. But when government is deciding that you're only worth X number of dollars a year, you know, you're going to be as mad as a hornet. But putting together a new plan that'll make everybody happy is impossible because you're dividing resources. And so what Hayek says is this destroys democracy. And what eventually happens is that it turns into dictatorship. It turns into, you get a strong man in there. You know, Hitler got elected. Okay, you get a strong guy in there who says, darn it all, I got the plan and I'm just going to shove it down everybody's throat.
Sure.
Because, and this all began when you went down this path toward having government run all of these things as no business running.
So that's their democratic socialism that they talk about all the time?
Well, that's right. And
they make it sound like, no, that's the good socialism.
Yeah,
democratic socialism. That's
right.
That's the good socialism.
And that's exactly what Hayek is demonstrating doesn't work. Socialism destroys democracy because it tries to make it do too many things. It's mm-hmm. It can work in terms of just basic laws and things like that. But when you get into all this other stuff, it stops working. And you don't go to your congressman, you know, when they won't let you do what you want in your own backyard, or you're not getting the medical things you want, or the Consumer Protection Bureau is telling you what investments you can make and what you can't make, and your life is being micromanaged by all these people. Your congressman can't do anything about it. Because these are bureaucrats who are running this.
Well, we saw that a lot during the Obama administration.
Yeah.
And for the people that didn't intersect with government or bureaucracy during that time period, I mean, hooray for you. But for the people
they didn't think they were impacted by it because they never had an issue with it.
No. But for the people who did, when the members of Congress went to the bureaucrats, who are the executive branch, so now we have to have a little bit of civics, you know, people don't always focus on the civics, but, you know, we have three co-equal branches of government, ideally, and all the bureaucracy is in the executive branch. So when you have a guy like Obama who really doesn't follow the rule of law and doesn't intend to make anybody else do it either, the bureaucrats look at the elected people on the legislative side, and they just
thumb their nose at them,
give them the finger and keep walking.
Because they don't have any...
They know nothing will happen to them if they do the wrong thing.
And it's worth noting, if you're rich and powerful enough, you know, you can get through to some of the stuff. But it's funny because it's ironic because it's exactly the opposite of what the socialists want. The socialists, you know...
They want the rich people to be punished.
Yeah, that's right. But they get the exact opposite. Okay? The rich people, you know, can get their congressman on the phone. The rich people can get the head of, you know,
right,
whatever they
but
need
I guess
to get
my
on the phone.
Point is, under a bureaucracy that's running lawless, you can get your congressman on the phone all day long and he can't do a thing about it.
Sure.
They don't care.
But they don't enforce.
The poorer you are, the less likely you are to get any of these people to take you seriously. And it's funny because it's exactly the opposite. In capitalism, it actually makes the poor people, you know, not more powerful than the rich people, but gives the poor people more actual power than socialism does, because it gives them the power in the marketplace. You know, if you're going buying something at a store, they want you back there at that store. I mean, they value each and every customer.
Sure.
If I'm dissatisfied with something, you know, if I go to a restaurant, I don't like the meal, or if I go to Walmart and the product is not what I expect it to be, bend over backwards to try to make me happy. Okay, I've seen them go farther than I would have gone to make me happy. It's the minute you start complaining, it's incredibly clear how much they do not want you to go away mad. You go to your local death panel, your local, you know, Obamacare review board, and see how much they care about what. Go to the Registry of Motor Vehicles and see if they care whether you're going away happy or unhappy. Okay, they wouldn't care if you dropped dead right in the middle of their room, you know, until you started to stink.
But it's funny because if you look, you were saying that, I was thinking of McDonald's. I mean, you know, McDonald's is still, you know, relatively cheap. I would imagine they see a lower strata of income by and large,
sure,
just because people can afford it. And yet, what have they done? You know, they're making things like a cafe now, you know. They've really upgraded their image inside. They've added Playland. They've added all these things.
Well, they're trying to make their customers happy.
I mean, they're
because both on a larger scale and on an individual level.
Yeah.
If you complain, they will go to very significant lengths to make you happy.
Sure. Because in the long run, that's what pays their bills.
In the long run, that's what's in their interest. And it's just fascinating because it's exactly, it's like opposite land. Because the socialists think that the capitalists don't care about the little guy and that the socialist system will care about the little guy. And it's exactly 100% the opposite. And when we determine these things through democracy, what we're in effect doing is, there's, you know, 300 million plus people in the country, we're effectively making people less powerful instead of more powerful. Because even if, you know, I totally convince my congressman that the Obamacare bureaucrats are screwing me over, you know, can I get my congressman out of office? I mean, would that even if I could, would that help? Would that change the bureaucrat? Nope. I mean, I'm a million miles away from actually changing this.
Yeah. And the congressmen aren't in charge of the bureaucrats anyway. They have no direct supervision.
The congressman's not in charge of it. I probably couldn't by myself throw him out of office anyhow. Okay. I'm like miles away from actually accomplishing anything. Whereas in a capitalist system, it's exactly the opposite. You know, just try this. You know, complain at your local store, and you'll be amazed at the difference in the attitude you get there than you get, let's say, at the Registry of Motor Vehicles. And what all this whole socialist model is about getting us all into the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah. All right.
Good example. I don't care what state you live in. All right. Quick break to celebrate some capitalism, and we'll be right back with our guest, Lauren Spivak. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Sorry, I was sleeping.
Okay, 7 minutes or slightly more.
Make it all make sense.
bring it home, Lauren.
I'll give you a little bit of history. The Atlantic Charter was a document signed by President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill on a battleship off the coast of Canada in 1940. And what they were, or maybe it was 41, what they were endeavoring to do was to explain what World War II was about. It was basically a charter of war aims. We are going to war, we're fighting the Germans and the Japanese to achieve what? And they made a list of goals, and one of them, and probably the most famous one, is they said the right of all people to choose the government under which they live. And I read that and I said, well, I guess they failed. Because I don't get to choose the government under which I live. And I wondered about that, but I realized they had just slightly misworded it. What they meant to say is the right to choose the government under which you live if you're in the majority. Okay? Then you get the right to choose the government under which you live. If you're not in the majority, you get nothing.
You're out. You get what you get.
You get nothing. And what I would like to have is a system where individual people have rights. I think that the, you know, majorities oppress minorities. And it's particularly amusing when leftists, you know, think that democracy is the solution to everything. Because, you know, I point out to them that, you know, the majority of the people of the country, you know, are white, you know, are Christian, are things that, you know, the left doesn't particularly like. And historically, majorities have always oppressed minorities. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the hobby of all majorities everywhere,
sure,
is to kick the minority around. So what I think is far, far more important than the rights of majorities, which really don't have to be protected because they're the majority, is the rights of individuals. That is what makes America special, is not majority rule, but minority rights. And the fundamental right of rights of the individual, you know, include some things that are clearly in the Constitution, like free speech and freedom of religion. You know, do you want the majority to decide that? I don't think so. But it also also includes the right to decide what to do with your own property, the right to keep the fruit of your own labor, the right to pursue your own political goals and communicate your ideas to your fellow citizens. And this stuff is what we ought to turn to. And we've kind of been pulled away from this by this siren song of democracy, where people, you know, can vote for candidates they like. They're, you know, the guy is handsome, he's articulate, he talks really well into a camera. But we've gotten very far away from what actually makes a wise governing policies. And so the two-pronged approach to what where wisdom really comes from, and by the way, you know, we talked at one point about my first seminar. My third seminar is called The Search for Superhuman Wisdom, and it's all about this. And there's two answers to that. One is on an individual level, we have far more wisdom that individuals have about their own life, their own property, their own family than the government does. We talked about that. Mm-hmm. The second one is that we are the heirs of some really, really great Republican with a small r ideas. And that tells us that a few small things have to be against the law, and that there's fundamental rights in terms of the criminal justice system and the presumption of innocence and trial by jury. And by the way, those are dying before democracy also. The fact that we can try people twice for the same crime, if the federal government tries them and the state government tries them, I don't know if you're into civil asset forfeiture, but the, you know, government's now taking away people's, you know, property without any trial, any court at all. So these things are falling by the wayside because of ideas that, you know, you can sell to the voting populace, but are detrimental to our fundamental human rights. And so my solution to what's better than having democracy side things is, one is to hang on to those traditions that have made us a free people all this time, and second of all, to live to make the day-to-day decisions in the hands of the individual people, as opposed to trying to centralize it by some authority, even if some temporary, you know, majority, and majorities come and go with the wind, you know, happens to support it at this moment.
Yeah, and we've actually turned to the exact opposite. I mean, we're doing the opposite right now.
That's right.
We're letting, you know, centralized or non-centralized government tell us what to do.
But how the left is dealing with the minority, right, regardless of what kind it is, whether it's a race or a religion or whatever, they want them to have special rights. So instead of individual rights covering everybody,
group rights,
now we want this weird centralized everything. And 2 minutes. We all have to stop talking so we can look at the clock and know we have 2 minutes. Instead, now we have to have special rights now. So everyone's little private thing
has to be
enshrined.
We don't all operate under the same set of rules
anymore. And that, I would imagine,
The left wants a lot of things that are very illogical. The last time I was in an argument with a socialist, he was saying that how we distribute all the money in the country should be decided by democracy. And I said, don't you understand that the majority oppresses the minority? And he said, well, we'll make laws to protect the minority.
I said, who's
making laws to protect the minority? The majority? Who makes the laws to protect the minority? Okay? Under his system, the majority. We're like chasing our tail.
Yep. It's mob rule.
You either base your society first and foremost on the fundamental rights of individuals, or you are endlessly at the mercy of temporary majorities waxing and waning from day to day.
What a mess.
And they're no wiser than anybody else.
Yeah. Bad road to travel. Yeah. Tell people how they can get a hold of you, because you teach.
Sure, my
at
website.
No charge.
My website. You can see about my books, but you can also contact me. Is drtruthbooks.com, which is drtruthbooks, all one word, .com.
Great.
Perfect. And they can find your email and all that, request that you come speak to their group or do one of your seminars. You have three seminars.
I do.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you, Lauren.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
It's been a ball.
You're the best show on the radio. Always happy to be here.
Okay,
love it.
I'll slip you the 20.
We could go down any rabbit hole with you. Thanks a million.
And welcome back. This is hour number two of We the People for July 2nd, 2017. I'm Bob Martin, and again, the first hour that you just heard featured our guest from last week with an encore hour, although not in the traditional sense, as in it was not a replay, but a third hour that we recorded after the regular show last week and played it for the first time on We the People in this just concluded hour. Now, the second hour today, as Aaron and Bill have the day off, is actually an interview that Aaron conducted recently when she was filling in for Carl and Linda Bott on Free Fire Radio, the show you hear every weekday morning on AM 1460. Aaron's special guest is Brad Fitch, the president and CEO of the Congressional Management Foundation, and he's going to tell you all about how Congress really works. So we will get to that interview now. It's going to sound a little different from the regular We the People broadcast because Bill is not there and I am not there. But Aaron has, it was an outstanding interview. Brad was an outstanding guest, and we wanted to share it with you on today's edition of We the People. And on behalf of Aaron and Bill, we, all of us here at We the People and AM 1460, Casey and I wish you a happy and safe 4th of July. And we'll get that interview underway now with Aaron and special guest Bill Fitch. I'm sorry.
Ha, good.
I couldn't let that go. Bill Fitch is the old-time basketball coach. It's Aaron and Brad Fitch now on We the People Radio.
Ha, good morning. It's Friday morning, so we can goof around a little bit. My name is Aaron Ryan, filling in for Carl Bott.
And I'm Sam Dorsey, filling in for Linda.
Linda.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's all right, so let's tell you about Brad a little bit, because this is kind of fun. He's calling us from Washington, so he should be fully awake, unlike the rest of us here. But Bradford Fitch has spent 25 years in Washington as a journalist, congressional aide, consultant, college instructor, internet entrepreneur, and writer and researcher. He began his career in radio and television as a reporter in the 1980s. He began working on Capitol Hill in 88, where he served for 13 years. He's worked in a variety of positions for members of Congress, including press secretary, campaign manager, legislative director, and chief of staff. So he's done all sorts of stuff.
That's quite the resume.
I know, and he is currently the... Why did I not highlight that part? He is the president and CEO. He is, because I just remember that part. Yeah, here we go. It's on top. President and CEO of the Congressional Management Foundation. And those guys, they create resources for Congress. They'll train staff. They also do a lot with the public on citizen engagement. So they help people be more effective advocates. And heaven knows that, most people haven't done that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On their website, the first thing there is how to effectively engage lawmakers at town halls. So it's pretty straightforward.
Ooh, I missed that
with
part.
That. Yeah, right there.
Because their site is congressfoundation.org, if you want to look that up. Very, 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 very helpful. What's happening over there? We can see Brad. Hi, Brad. Oh, Brad can hear us. He waved.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hello.
We've never actually, I've actually never had somebody on Skype that was on the, actually on the video. So it's kind of fun. We can actually see you. So we told people kind of who you are a little bit, but we thought we'd let you, whoops.
I turned off my video.
Oh, darn it. It was fun for a second there.
Yeah.
We thought we'd let you kind of give us a, little update on what you guys are doing, how people, I gave them your website, but how you can help them, because you have a lot of tools for the public.
Well, thank you, Aaron, and I'm delighted to be here. Our mission is now twofold. We have two parts of our mission. One part is to help the Congress improve how it interacts with citizens. The other part is how citizens interact with the Congress. If we do our job right, better laws are made. And in the citizen area, we've actually added some more resources, to be honest, as a result of some of the real explosion in citizen engagement that's happened since the inauguration. We created a citizen advocate toolkit on our website. So if you go to our website, basically we had a lot of other resources that were frankly jumbled up in different sections, and we decided to put them in one, frankly, web page. So you can see articles, reports, videos on how citizens can use things, as you noted, like town hall meetings or letters to the editor or just, you know, basic garden variety meetings with their elected officials and how to make them more effective and engaging. One of the myths out there is that Congress doesn't want to interact with citizens, or that Congress is closing down and actually is receding, or having even fewer town hall meetings. In fact, the opposite is true. Members are constantly seeking outreach and seeking an opportunity to interact with citizens. They do it for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, they're just outgoing human beings. I mean, they like to be liked. Remember, these are politicians.
Yeah, they didn't run for office to hide in an office.
Exactly. And I was interviewing a member of Congress for a book I wrote a few years ago on citizen engagement, and she said, I think all members of Congress are still middle children trying to please their father. And if you keep that in mind and know that they are, hand-holding, baby-kissing politicians that are actually wonks at heart that want to pass public policy, it makes it a lot easier to interact with them. And I'm always pleasantly surprised and encouraged when groups that we train will come out of a meeting with a member of Congress thinking that, you know, they had horns and a tail going into it, and then coming out, wow, she was really nice. I was really surprised. And I'm like, well, she's a politician. She wants to be nice to you. She wants to help you. That's what they do. They're public officials. That's why they make these incredible sacrifices. So we do want to encourage citizens to have these types of interactions that are meaningful, that lead to relationships with the lawmaker and the citizen, and that usually results in a more positive experience for both parties.
Nice. And you guys are also the Mythbusters. How about this? We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, maybe you can give us some of the top myths that people believe about Congress that are really not true. I like that part of your service the best, because it's very hard to diffuse some of that stuff.
Yes.
They're in office for, you know, a year, and then they get their salary for life. That's my favorite. Because it's like, well, where could that possibly be true in the real world? Anyway, we'll be right back. Our guest is Brad Fitch from the Congressional Management Foundation. We're here subbing for Carl and Linda because they're on vacation. God love them. Sorry, Carl doesn't like the music. We like the music.
Yeah, I'm digging it.
Just a little respect, huh? That's kind of funny. There was a postcard delivered at the last town hall that the local congressman had that said, women demand respect, except it was spelled R-E-S-P-E-T.
Respect.
So, anyway, that song's always funny to me. After that, so Brad, what are some of the great myths?
Well, I do occasional C-SPAN gigs on Washington Journal, which as you can imagine, if I'm talking about how people, voices can make a difference, how Congress are really hardworking public servants, not exactly the talking points that the C-SPAN crowd wants to listen to. And I've heard a couple of myths that come in through. I just recently did one. You mentioned the health care one. There's the belief that the members of Congress have some kind of health care, or their health care is paid for by 100%. And in fact, their health care is almost identical to what you would get in any large organization. I mean, keep in mind, they work in the federal government with 3 million people. Having said that, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, the Congress put in a provision that forced all members of Congress and their staff, almost all staff, into the exchanges, which were designed for individuals. So all of members of Congress are in the D.C. exchange, but their employer, in this case the Congress, does continue to play an employer contribution just as you would in the private sector. And, in fact, it's about 23% paid for by the federal government. And, in fact, more than half of all Americans work in a company or an organization that has that same type of benefit. So it's pretty garden variety. The only extra benefit they get is they can do some outpatient work at military hospitals in the D.C. area, and I don't know why that was put in place. My guess is that if your doctor is back home in Poughkeepsie or Sacramento or Redding, you need access to a medical facility, and they wanted to make it easy for members of Congress. But we've heard all sorts of crazy perks, you know, like they have pension for life after 2 years, which is not true. Their pension vests like every other, you know, normal employee after 20 years. They do get a pension, which is unusual, obviously, in America these days, but most government employees get some kind of pension. Most of their retirement plan is similar to a 401k. It's called the Thrift Savings Plan. And, you know, like most 401ks, it's pretty good. They get a match, you know, from their employer. So it's pretty much, again, like a standard employer gets. But, you know, some of the other crazy myths, I remember my favorite one. And this was a thing on the internet. I had to look it up afterwards because I hadn't heard about this one. Was that when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker, she had her own private 747 jet?
Yes, I hear that a lot too. Is that fake?
Do you? Yeah, that was a great one. That was really good. And no, she had a security detail. They flew her a couple times on a 747 because it couldn't refuel. They didn't want to, you know, land a plane where Speaker Hastert can get, when he was Speaker, could get to Chicago in a smaller plane. But in general, no, she didn't have that.
But those are
some of the things that we hear. There is, I actually do, when I get together with relatives outside of D.C., and you can imagine, again, lively conversation over the Thanksgiving Day table, I do play Name That Perk, because members of Congress do have three perks that most Americans don't get. Most of the perks were wiped out in the 80s and 90s as a result of ethics reform and things like that. So no more free lunches. The trips that they go on are pretty much business trips, and I can come back to the value of those trips in a second, because one of the reasons we have gridlock in Washington is because members are traveling less with their colleagues and with each other. But let me come back to that in a minute, because let's play Name That Perk. So I'll give it to you, our host here. Can you name, what do you think might be one perk out of three? There's only three left. They have three perks. Do you know a perk of a member of Congress has?
They get to use the gym?
Well, yes, but that's not quite a perk.
I know. It was a desperate attempt. That.
So that throws out my guess of free lunch.
Yeah, no free lunches.
Really? No free lunch. Okay.
Yep, no more free lunch. You got to buy your lunches. And the receptions at the fundraisers on Washington, D.C. aren't that great because they're trying to save money on food and bring in money for campaigns. So
I know they have to pay for their own housing, right?
Right.
Pay for their own housing.
But actually, you're close to one. One is they do have a tax credit that's been in place for about 100 years now. They get a $3,000 tax credit because they're expected to maintain two homes. So they do have a tax credit. The other one does have to do with travel. Every member of Congress, there's a special parking lot at National Airport for members of Congress and the Supreme Court.
Oh.
And I've never quite understood why the Supreme Court has it, because they don't travel.
I was going to say, where are they going?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. And
Vegas.
Then the third one that I think is really lavish, actually, is when they do travel on official business or unofficial business, when someone pays for a trip, they are allowed to bring a spouse or a family member with them. And that's a little rare. That's usually only CEOs of major companies get that perk. But they do, and again, the reasoning is the average work week for a member of Congress when they're in session is 70 hours a week. When they're back home, it's 59 hours a week. And now I know, I'm talking about their work ethic, not their work product. I'm perfectly aware that a lot of Americans have a problem with the congressional work product, but they're spending a lot of time at work. So I think that the trade-off is if you do have to do work for travel where you're going on these trips, that a family member can come along. But those are the only three perks left. There's really nothing left. There used to be in the 80s and the 70s. There were a lot of perks, and I started working on Capitol Hill in 1988, but I've also talked to, you know, kind of the old guys who were mostly men, who were working in the 70s. And, I mean, they were tickets to the Redskin game, to the Kennedy Center. You know, the lobbyists at Christmas time would, you know, literally bring their cart of booze around and pass out bottles to Johnny Walker, you know, and plenty of vodka. I mean, that was Congress in the 70s, and we're all like saying, why didn't it work back then?
Yeah, really. We should have gotten a lot more done back then.
This time in 1988, when I started in 1988 through 90, Nabisco would walk up with these giant boxes of products, and they'd come in with these gift boxes, and they'd have cookies and crackers and, you know, all sorts of stuff that they would give to congressional offices, and that's, you know, gone the way of the dodo bird. That kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore on Capitol Hill.
You don't want all that snacking.
Yeah, like...
Right.
Would he be tired all the time?
Why?
Well, there is one funny – speaking of snacks, there is one funny loophole in the ethics laws. You can accept gifts if it's a home product. So, for example, if you represent Atlanta, you can take Coke products. You can take Coca-Cola. And what this has evolved into is an underground black market of exchanging gifts between the junior staff members who don't, you know, make a lot of money. So you got the guy from Atlanta, you know, calling Hershey, Pennsylvania, hey, I'll trade you Coca-Cola for Hershey bars. So that's actually happening a little bit, and that's kind of funny. But that's the only thing. So if
it's
you're
like
going
mash.
To an office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you go into an office, you'll actually see some of those home products on display, and they are allowed to accept those, and they usually give them out as gifts to constituents who come visit.
Oh, well, that's kind of fun.
Yeah,
I don't get why it's called a home product though, because like I'm thinking Comet or sponges or something.
I was thinking
not
baked,
that kind of
like baked goods.
Oh, you are?
Your mom makes.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about cleaning. Huh? Must be an age thing.
So why did they have this push to kind of remove all these perks? Or, like, how did that start? Do you know?
Well, each scandal befell another series of election reforms. The last one was in 2007, and that was a result of the Jack Abramoff affair. If you might remember, Jack Abramoff was a very flamboyant lobbyist who worked for Indians, nations, and really took advantage of them. He ended up being convicted. People forget that it was a congressional investigation that actually brought out the Abramoff affair, led by John McCain as chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee. And that was actually what brought out the Abramoff affair. And unfortunately, Abramoff became a bit of a poster child, people thinking all lobbyists are like Abramoff. And it's not. He was a complete aberration. I mean, there was a reason he was called Fast Jack. And they made a movie of him with Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it wasn't that good a movie, so most people didn't see it. But anyway, people still have the impression that that's the way Washington works. And it's not. Most lobbyists in Washington, D.C. are actually representing a doctor or a patient. That's, and I say most, that's a plurality, whether it's the Alzheimer's Association, the American Medical Association. I mean, every doctor profession has a lobbyist. And so that's what really lobbying is. Having said that, unfortunately, they pushed through this law in 2007, the first draining of the swamp that was announced, called the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, and that was the last big ethics law that was passed. And that completely banned any kind of gift, any kind of meal. Up until that point, you could go to lunch and accept up to a $50 lunch with a lobbyist. And in 2007, that law was banned. And in fact, I was actually talking with some former congressional staffers, and they think that effect has actually been negative in the effect that it has inhibited the ability of staffers to collect data in a casual setting, to build relationships with the industries that they regulate and they pass laws on. And just in general, there's been just a clamping down of bipartisan travel. And I alluded to that. And that's a bad thing. I mean, that when these members of Congress travel, they build relationships with one another. I was just listening to a member of Congress on a telephone town hall meeting just last night, who's a member of the Armed Services Committee. And he was talking about building a relationship, he was a Democrat, with a Republican because they went on this trip together. And that is what happens. Our research shows that these social relationships lead to legislative relationships. And if you go back as far as like 1986 and the Great Compromise that led to tax reform during the Reagan administration, many people point to the fact that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, a Democrat from Illinois, had a good relationship with Bob Michael, the House Minority Leader. And the reason they were able to come to a compromise was because they had traveled together and they had gotten to know each other. And so I think that is one of the unintended consequences of these ethics reforms. And I'm not bashing the 2007 law, because there's a lot of good things, sure, I believe, in that law as well. But the unintended consequence is we do have fewer bipartisan relationships. We do have staff that are less informed in the decisions that they make because they're not allowed to socialize in any way, shape, or form, in any logical way. And unfortunately, that means that, frankly, some of the laws we have, or at least the attempted laws, don't happen.
Yeah, and they get a little disjointed. That's kind of interesting. How about this? Take a quick break. When we come back, could you talk to us a little bit about the budgeting for Congress? Because when people hear that Congress's budget hasn't been increased for a while and you have all the details on that, I don't think they realize what that means to them. And maybe we could use that as a little bit of a gateway into, you know, how this affects folks at home and what they can do about it. So we're going to pick your brain. We're going to fully pick your brain as quickly as we can in the time we have with you. So we appreciate you coming on with us. We're speaking with Brad Fitch. He is the president and CEO from the Congressional Management Foundation. You can find their information at congressfoundation.org. And you're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
Talk about destruction. Don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright.
Just a quick reminder, again, on this edition of We the People, we're hearing a replay of an interview Erin did recently when she was filling in on our weekday morning show, Free Fire Radio, here on AM 1460 KCNR. And Erin's special guest is Brad Fitch, the CEO of the Congressional Management Association. And we continue.
Hear us streaming 24/7 at KCNR1460.com.
Hello, we are back.
That was Sam.
Yes.
All right, Brad. So what do we know about congressional resources, and why do people care about that?
Well, first, and this is, again, going to make me sound a little bit like a champion for Congress. I'm more of just an explainer of Congress. Let's look at the congressional budget in context of the federal government. Many people think that, you know, there's a lot of lavish spending going on. In fact, the U.S. Congress, or the legislative branch of our government, represents 0.1% of our budget. 0.1%
No kidding.
Of the budget. And so it's very small in comparison to any other department. Members of Congress pay is actually, it sounds lavish because it's $174,000 a year, and that's way more than most Americans actually get. But in reality, most members of Congress are taking a pay cut. They're lawyers. Half of them are lawyers. They're doctors. They're, you know, in other professions that they could make more money. Each member of the House of Representatives has a budget of about $1.3 million. They have to spend it on certain things. They can't spend it on things like parties or food or liquor or anything like that. They got to spend it on furniture, district office rent, computers, software, garden variety stuff like paper, reimbursing for mileage for staff to travel around the district. One of the interesting statistics that most people don't know is that only one agency, only one government entity in the last 6 years has actually cut its budget, and that's the U.S. House of Representatives. Starting in 2011, they felt they wanted to demonstrate symbolism because they were cutting other agencies at the time. Things were, belt tightening was going on. And so between 2011 and 2014, every congressional House office experienced about a 20% cut in their budget. And that's a real cut. I mean, that was like from 1.4 million to about 1.2 million. And it resulted in either laying off or through attrition, losing one full-time employee. So if their average, they had 17 employees, it went down to 16 employees. And that has a direct impact on citizens. If you've got four people in the district office that are responding to constituent requests, which often come in, whether it's immigration status or their grandfather lost their World War II medals or their Social Security check wasn't delivered, or I heard a great one the other day where a veteran couldn't convince the VA that he was alive.
Yep. I was just going to say that's their favorite.
The VA thought he was dead and so wasn't providing VA benefits. And he's like, no, I'm talking to you on the phone. I'm not dead. And, you know, the person, the other, no, you're dead. It's right here on paper. I got it in the computer. So this is requires the intervention of a congressional office. Well, instead of having four people working on those, now they have three. So instead of taking a month to resolve that problem, maybe it takes a month and a half or 2 months because they've got to do more work. And it's just any type of customer service operation. Congress is like a business. A small business, and if you've got less people serving the customers, you're going to get less service. It just is a supply and demand. This is just a logical mathematical equation. And so that's the challenge that the Congress faces, is always asking to do more with less. Add to that an extraordinary explosion in constituent communications, especially in the last 6 months, primarily as a result of the internet. Every congressional office since 2001 has experienced anywhere from a 500% to a 1,000% increase in constituent communications over that period of time. And then it went even up in January, probably as a result of the Trump administration and some of the proposals. We've got some congressional offices that, compared to a year ago, have seen a 900% increase in constituent communications, 900% increase. And they don't have more staff to answer it. They just got to figure out how to reply to these constituents. So that's some of the challenges they face from a budgeting standpoint. It is frustrating because they want to do more, they want to serve constituents, but it's really hard as demand is increasing and their budgets are not.
And you look at districts like ours, here in the North State that Reading would be part of, and this is 11 counties. I know everyone has the same number of people in their district, but when you get up here, the geography is such that we're 11 counties that stretch from Sacramento all the way to the Oregon border. So
the other thing that you'll
drive
see,
time and
this
all the rest
really
of it is
important.
A lot.
Yeah, and that's a challenge when you have these geographically stretched out counties. You got to have your staff travel from county to county, although the technology allows for a lot of teleworking. The other thing that's been cut in the last 30 years is regrettably what we call the intellectual infrastructure of the Congress. You know, the Congress plays on the same policy playing field as some other pretty big players like the White House and the executive branch and the lobbyist on K Street. And they've got to attempt to bring the same resources to bear. But because the Congress has consistently cut its budgets and cut its intellectual infrastructure, it makes it less equipped to do battle in this playing field. So you look at things like the Congressional Research Service, which is an arm of the Library of Congress, which is there to provide answers to questions, and they're policy experts on everything from nuclear weapons proliferation to biotechnology. They've seen cuts at the Congressional Research Service. They eliminated a really bipartisan independent agency in the 1990s called the Office of Technology Assistance, sometimes called the last honest man in Washington, and that was eliminated. You've seen cuts to the General General Accountability Office, which is, the auditors that go in and look at whether agencies are performing well and if they are doing their job or doing what they're being told to do through the laws and the regulations that are passed. And one author said it's as if Congress gave itself a frontal lobotomy. And that has, again, serious implications. You know, if you've got members of Congress that are trying to wrestle with questions like, how do we keep our electrical grid safe from cyber attacks, and they don't have an expert that is equipped in cybersecurity and electrical grids that has experience in that area, and by the way, I'm not making this up, this is some of the challenges they face, that has real implications for citizens.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It really does.
So sort of in an effort to represent the interests of their constituents, they have hurt their ability to represent their interests of their constituents.
That's a rather circular and accurate way of saying it, yeah. But we don't want to give the impression that people, they don't listen to the people and they don't have resources to listen to the people. I mean, members of Congress are listening so hard they're going deaf. We haven't talked about social media yet and probably should touch on it because social media is a wonderful addition and a new window and way into Congress. And members of Congress are taking ample advantage primarily of Facebook and Twitter to interact with citizens. And what our research has shown is that a few citizens, like a couple dozen, if they're commenting on a member of Congress's Facebook page or Twitter, the members will pay attention to that. Remember, they're these people that want this attention, and they view social media as a way to get an instant reaction to what they're doing in Congress. I was about to do an interview on C-SPAN a couple years ago, and the person who was ahead of me in Washington Journal was a congresswoman talking about the debt ceiling, and her press secretary was in the waiting room with me. And she's watching the interview, and she's looking at the congresswoman's Twitter feed, and she's commenting, oh, someone liked that comment. Oh, they didn't like that. She's getting a line-by-line analysis of the interview on C-SPAN. And I asked the press secretary, is the congresswoman going to see that feed after this interview? She said, are you kidding? She's going to grab this from me before she gets to the elevator. She loves this stuff. And so it's a really robust and authentic way to have a conversation with an elected official.
That's pretty great. And you have direct access at that point because a lot of what has been done are big, faxing campaigns and that kind of thing. How effective are those?
Not very effective. In fact, we recently issued a report, and I encourage people, it's a free report on our website at congressfoundation.org, and it came out in January called Citizen-Centric Advocacy, the Untapped Power of Citizen Engagement. And we looked at our survey data of congressional staff going back 12 years, 9 surveys, nearly 1,200 staff responses went into this data. And what it shows is the Congress is moving away from not paying attention, but really integrating these mass email campaigns that are the dominant form of what passes for dialogue coming into their offices. And what they're looking for more are robust relationship building efforts. So those people that will participate in a telephone town hall meeting or set up a meeting with their friends and the member of Congress in the district office or get to know the staff members. And we did research over time, and it shows that those people that build relationships, that communicate to the legislator the local impact of a decision and personalize it, and the power of personal stories cannot be understated. It's really incredible how powerful personal storytelling can be in an advocacy effort. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for that type of thing. They'll count the mass email campaigns in many cases, although in some cases they won't, depending upon the office, but many times they'll count it, but it's just not the same thing, and it's not remotely going to have an impact. Let me just add a caveat to this. I'm not saying that emailing members of Congress is bad. Quite the opposite. If you individualize that message, if you put in a little bit about how you're affected by this bill. Let's say you want to talk about the Republican proposal on health care, and you have a pre-existing condition, and you're concerned that you might not be able to get health care coverage if this bill is passed into law, or if you're a small business that feels burdened by regulation. Or let's say you've got a health care plan, and you've got a, $20,000deductible, and it costs you $20,000 a year. And those are some of the stories that members of Congress have heard. That's something that Congress wants to hear from. They want to hear from you those kinds of stories. And if you individualize it and put it in an email message, that'll get through to the member of Congress.
Nice. All right. Take one quick break, and maybe when we come back, you can talk to us a little bit about how people could be more effective at the local level, because most people aren't traveling to Washington, D.C. to speak with their member of Congress. They're dealing in their district offices and that kind of thing, and we've seen that be fairly dysfunctional of late, so maybe some hot tips for those folks.
And this is KCNR 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State. I know where I'll be tomorrow, in Corning at a Veterans Expo. Oh, fun.
All right, Brad. So how can people stop this dysfunctional chaos that they've got going on?
Heck if I know.
I like that deep breath.
If you're talking about, you know, the chaos that appears at whether it be at town hall meetings or, you know, citizen interaction, we're actually doing some research on that right now. And this is an unusual period of time for people attending town hall meetings. The average number of people at during a normal period is about, you know, 20, 30 people at a town hall meeting. Right now, we're tracking in the last, you know, sort of 100 or so town hall meetings we tracked in the last 2 months. The average is about 240 people. Now, I'm one of these people that kind of think that's a good thing, you know, that 240, you know, on average, you know, people come out on a Tuesday night to talk about healthcare or Russia investigations or, you know, Trump taxes, and they're doing that instead of watching American Idol. I think that's kind of good for democracy. What's bad for democracy is when people come out and they shout at their congressman, they yell. There was a guy who went to a town hall meeting recently who had a sign, and the sign said, "I didn't come here to listen to you. I came here to yell."
Yeah.
You might as well just put on the sign, "I came here to be ineffective. I'm wasting my time," because that's what they're doing. They're wasting their time. It doesn't make a lot of sense. What is effective are those people who come with thoughtful questions, who ask serious questions, who have done a little research, who can tell personal stories. If you can get together with other people in a group and go for a meeting with a senior staff member of the congressional office or the member themselves, they will take those meetings, pick up the phone and do that. And if you don't believe me, I've got a blog on my website that I wrote and a video that connects to it about a guy named Bob O'Hara. And Bob, this is a true story. Bob was just John Q. Citizen living in Massachusetts, and like many people, were frustrated with gridlock and what he was going to do about it, and he decided to get involved with this bipartisan group called No Labels, and they were having their first sort of convention in Washington, D.C., and Bob came to Washington, and this is a true story because I met Bob 6 months ago, and he told me the story, and he actually saw a Congressional Management Foundation presentation on building relationships with lawmakers. And I was the presenter, and I said, "Look, you can set up meetings with your elected officials. You just got to pick up the phone and call them in their district office and ask for it." And he was skeptical, but he saw some other panelists say the same thing, so he did it. Bob has now met with every member of his congressional delegation in Massachusetts. He's been to Washington 4 times. He's, you know, again, he's not a big lobbyist. He's not a contributor to campaigns. He's just a John Q. public. And if you Google Bob O'Hara and Congressional Management Foundation, or Bob O'Hara and No Labels. You'll see his 10-minute video on how he does it. And you can also read about him in our case study that we referenced in our on our website, congressfoundation.org, in the Citizen-Centric Advocacy Report. So part of the bringing down the volume, part of bringing down the noise, and frankly, being a little more civil to one another, is engaging one another and engaging elected officials in the same way you would want to be treated, in the same way you would talk to your doctor or your neighbor or a friend. And that actually is very effective. Members of Congress find that very helpful to interacting with citizens.
So rather than roll in with 20, 25 people in the media and then just jam up their time for an hour and a half and yell at them about how they work for you, probably not super effective at getting their ear?
No, well, it'll get their ear, but they'll ignore it. I mean, they'll in the end, they're not, they're not.
Because people are being told to do that. That seems to be the latest instruction out there is, go waste, they literally go waste their time.
Yeah,
because,
like jam phone lines and stuff.
Yeah, go waste their time because they do not understand what really goes on in a district office, that people actually need staff to help them. They think we're just, people are just there to get yelled at.
Well, some people are encouraging that, and that's obviously not good advice. But even some of the newer guides that came out on the left of center, there's this group called Indivisible.
Right.
And they actually put out a pretty good 26-page guide. And I point out to people that the word protest is in that guide 5 times. The word polite is referenced 7 times. And I think people are picking and choosing, like, oh, bring a sign. Well, yeah, but it also says set up meetings with your elected officials in their district office. It says be prepared with a good question. And if you look at our work, we advise the same thing. And to plug myself a little bit and plug a book I wrote a book called Citizen's Handbook to Influencing Elected Officials a few years ago. And it's about a 70-page guide. And you can Google it and look at it at Amazon or download it on Kindle. It's not that expensive. And that also gives the same kind of advice that we offer in our report on citizen-centric advocacy.
See, and I think that's super, super useful. Do things that work, not because you want them to see you coming and think, oh, there's so-and-so. I wonder what they're doing today. Instead of,
Yeah.
Run away.
Panic.
That's pretty great. You also have Media Relations Handbook for Agencies, Associations, Nonprofits, and Congress. You have actually printed quite a bit of stuff. Is that all on the site? I didn't.
No, that's actually a different publisher, but it's available on Amazon as well. If you're a budding press secretary and want to learn how to deal with the media, that was a book I wrote some years ago.
Media and want to learn how they're going to deal with you.
yeah. It's things have changed a little bit from social media since I wrote that book, and I'm not as much an expert on social dealing with the media and social media. I am obviously knowledgeable about using social media to interact with Congress, as I referenced earlier. But I think the thing to take away from this is there's a quote that people often forget from Thomas Jefferson about citizen engagement, in which he said, "We in America are not a government by the majority. We're a government by the majority who participate." And I think one of the things the Tea Party demonstrated in 2009 and 2010 is they got out there and participated. And they may not have had an impact on the legislative agenda that the Democrats and President Obama was putting forward. In fact, they had no impact at all. But they did have an impact on the election. If they had changed tactics, they might have had an impact on the legislative process. What's happening right now is Indivisible and some of the left of center are taking a page out of that playbook, and they are doing the same thing, and they may or may not, but may come to the same results, where they'll have no impact on the legislative agenda, but they may have an election impact in 2018. We won't know until that comes around. And we won't know about how long this movement goes. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is it's now 5 months into sort of the anti-Trump movement since late January when it started. Well, the Tea Party movement really lasted about 8 months and went from about April of 2009 to early 2010. And then when the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, we looked at town hall meetings in February of 10, and they were nowhere near the numbers in August of 09. Well, we just looked at last week's town hall meetings, and there was an average of 230 people going to town hall meetings last week. That's 5 months into this. If this movement is sustained through the year, and we're looking at November town hall meetings with the same number, that will mean that this movement will be the most significant citizen engagement movement since the Vietnam War.
Wow.
Wow.
That would be pretty big, yeah. So we may be seeing something. I don't know yet. I'm not willing to say that yet, but I'm saying right now, you know, a lot of people are still coming out and they're still contacting Congress.
That's kind of great. Actually, you know, it's good. People are, you know, learning something about it and becoming active. That's always a good thing. Complacency is kind of how we got into this mess. I guess I figured that out back in 2009. I thought, what has happened? Busy working, busy doing other things, and lifted my head up and thought, what the heck is going on? So I know that that does happen for folks, and it beats the heck out of just sitting home and throwing shoes at the television.
Indeed.
You know, it's not terribly effective. So give folks your website and how they can contact you again, and then we'll let you have your day.
Our website is congressfoundation.org, and you can look at the area and citizen engagement. Just click on that, and you'll see a lot of our research out there. You'll find the Citizen Advocates Toolkit, which we have created for citizens to get involved, interact with their members of Congress, and just be more effective in our democracy.
Nice. And Congressional Operations tab will give you some more factual information. Thanks for putting that out, by the way, and for all your hot tips. We learned a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. Have a great day. That has been Brad Fitch with the Congressional Man Foundation. We'll be back. We're talking about charter schools the second hour around here.
This is KCNR, 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
I know. It makes you want to laugh a little.
I know.